For Parshas Noach, I want to start at the very beginning. We have what I have in front of you is really the, I think, the third pasuk in the parsha, right? So we start at the beginning, Ila Todos Noach, and the Torah tells us that Noach has three sons. Okay, then just overview, right? So we remember the story of Noach that the world is corrupt, is lawless. Right, things are have gone south. Hashem decides that Noach and his family are the only ones who are going to be saved. The flood wipes out everything else and everyone else. Noach is saved on the Teva with, you know, the animals that are there with him and his family. Okay, so that's the afterwards is the when Noach comes out of the Teva. Then there's a bris, right? There's a covenant. And Noach starts to rebuild. And then at the end of the parsha, we also have the story of Migdal Babel, right? So that's the Tower of Babel, right? The story of everybody starting to spread out even further. So they're all gathered together and they all work on this mission. Hashem mixes everybody up, all the different languages, and they end up spreading out all over the world. And at the very end, we are actually introduced to Avraham. It's kind of slipped in there at the end, and Avraham's family. So that's the overview of Parshas Noach, but I really want to focus on a point at the beginning of the Parsha. So the Torah tells us, "Vatishachis ha'aretz lifnei ha'lokim," that the earth, the world is again corrupt. "Vatishachis," is to be ruined, something like that. So vatimalei ha'aretz chamas. So the world, the earth is corrupted, and the world is filled with chamas. Okay, and then vayar Elokim es ha'aretz, and Hashem looks, Hashem sees the world, v'hinei nishchasa, and behold, it is nishchas. Behold, it is corrupted. Ki yishchis kol basar es darko al ha'aretz, because everything has been corrupted itself, corrupted its ways on the earth. Okay, so besides the fact that if you wanted to identify, right, there is clearly a word which is repeating, but it's not just, right, there's vatishachis, right, this shachas, shin ches tof. So any, just in general, if you see a word or a shoresh that seems to be repeated over and over again in a short span of time, right, so just as a note, right, that's usually something that's like a flag. You should pay attention to that, right? There's clearly like a theme, right? There's something going on. The fact that it like repeats the same word over and over again. So here it happens to be just these two psukim, and it says it three times. So that's kind of that's something to notice. But what I really want to focus on is that in terms of the actual like sentences, not just like the word that's repetitive, but here in terms of the sentence. So it says, "Vatishachis ha'aretz." So the earth becomes corrupted. "Vayar Elokim es ha'aretz," and God looks at the world. God sees the world, and behold, it is nishchas, and it is corrupted. Right, which is kind of like a weird repetition. It's not just that the word "vatishachis" is used multiple times. That not just the shoresh, but like as a sentence, as like a way of telling the story. It's kind of funny. The world was corrupted, and God looked, and behold, the world was corrupted. Right, it's kind of
coming down and judge the final judgment.
Okay, so this may be on the list of times when the Torah describes the way that Hashem Kilu comes to judge the world, comes to judge a situation that we're going to see later on by Avraham, right, by Stone, right? It describes it like that. Even at the end of this Parsha, right, it sounds a little bit by Migdal Bavel, by the tower, that Hashem, you know, comes down to see what's going on and takes a look at what's happening, right? So we have that. That may also tie into, if we think about, like, Shirim we've had before, right, when we talk about what was the language in Kisavo, right? We talked about I'm going to use the wrong verb in the end. It's like vayashkif or vayashkifu, right? So in Vayera it says vayashkifu. They look out towards Sodom, and we said vayashkifu, looking out, is usually a language of judgment. We pointed out that in Kisavo, it's the one time that verb is actually used for the good, right? But that idea that Hashem is like looking out towards something, right, sometimes implies that he's out there to judge, right? Hashem is looking. The issue here is I think you could have done without one of these sentences, right? I think in, to a certain extent, you could have kind of like cut it. You could have trimmed this, right? You could have said and Hashem looked and it was and things had gone wrong, or you could have said things went wrong and Hashem saw it. But it says like things went wrong and Hashem looked, right? And Hashem saw that things had gone wrong. It's that repetition, which seems kind of funny, that it's not just if it had said the world had been corrupted. And then Hashem said, things have gone bad, I better, right? And Hashem just launched into a speech. We would know because it's Hashem sees that things have gone bad. But it's this repetition which seems a little bit funny. So I want to talk about this phrasing that something happens and then Hashem sees that this happened. What's the reason to add that extra line that it happened and then Hashem saw that it happened and now he starts to react by saying, well, now I need to take steps in order to fix the problem. And it's the overall issue to deal with. So, before we get back to that, I want to talk a little bit about an idea. We're going to talk about an idea from Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. So, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter is a important personality from the 19th century. This is one of those situations where we have a word which may be familiar, and it has a particular. It is a word that comes up in Tanakh, right? It's not a word that was invented recently, but nowadays it has a particular meaning or it refers to a particular, I don't want to say philosophy, like a particular approach. And then sometimes it can get a little confusing because sometimes you see the word and it means this specific movement and sometimes it just means the word itself, right? So like one example of that would be chassid, right? A chassid, the word chassid is used, right? It's in Tanakh, Chazal use it. It's just a word that's used. And now we have the word, it was used to refer to a particular type of, you know, approach to Judaism, let's say, whatever, just broadly, right? So chassid, so nowadays if you say, oh, a person who, right, when the Gemara says, if you want to be a chassid, you should study, right? The brachos, or you should master nizigim, whatever it is, right? So mandabai chasida, right? If you want to be a chassid, you should learn this. And then, so if you learn that without context, right, without explaining, so then it'll be like, to be a chassid? I'm not a chassid. What does that mean if I want to be a chassid? Right, because the word means something in and of itself. It just means a pious person. It has particular meaning in Tanakh and in Chazal. And then it, over time, developed into a particular, you know, group that used that as like their term. So Rabbi Yisrael Salanter also, if we're aware, so he was the leader. He was kind of the founder, we might say, of the Mussar movement. So when we talk about Mussar nowadays is largely coming from what Rabbi Yisrael Salanter started in the 19th century, in the mid 19th century, leading a with his teachings and then his students and then his students' students that kind of lead to what would be, you know, the modern day study of Mussar. So the word Mussar, again, like it happens to me, the word Mussar, like, and Mussar Haskel, and like all these things, these phrases that we use nowadays, like they show up in Tanakh, right? Like if you look at Mishlei, like that's what they're talking about. But it didn't necessarily have the exact flavor that we're referring to nowadays, because the Mussar movement was brings with it a particular focus on character development, on understanding our own personalities and working on those in addition to, right, what we might call a classic Torah learning and Talmud study and all of those other sides that go with it. So Rav Shlomo Salanter in the 1800s, so part of his push was to help people refocus on not just some of the literal practical elements of Torah study, but also that it should come with it real work on ourselves, work on who we are, work on how we relate to and interact with the world and those around us, also with ourselves, right? It's not just about Bein Adam L'Chaver, it's not just treating others, but it's also the way that we understand ourselves. So that element of Mussar. So again, that nowadays when we say Mussar, like that's usually, often that's what we mean, right? We say giving, sometimes we say like giving somebody Mussar, right? Which itself, you know, now like has an implication of like, right? Again, this is part of going back to some of the original meaning of Musar, right? That like, but like we say, sometimes we think of giving Musar, and that would be like a rebuke, or right, we're like trying to correct somebody, we're trying to tell somebody that they did something wrong. That's like giving Musar, but that's not really. Again, that's not the entirety of what we mean when we talk about the Musar movement. So, so all of those things are just kind of things to keep in mind when we're understanding Rav Yisrael Salanter and the Musar movement. So he went around Europe trying to spread this message. He has a number of famous Talmidim who themselves started yeshivas in different places, and then many of the Rosh Yeshiva or Mashkichim, right, those who influenced others in the yeshiva, are really like rooted in his, you know, if not Rav Yisrael Salanter, and his students. So we've heard of Kelm or Navardik, which is actually a little bit less popular, but so there are some schools that really, started with students of Rav Yisrael Salanter. So what I have in front of you, oh, I also didn't even number them. That was my mistake. Okay, so this is source two. If we want to number them, source one is the Psukim. Source two is what we're up to right now. It's the Igeres HaMusar. So the Igeres HaMusar was written in the mid 1900s. According to the internet, when I looked it up, it was 1858 was first published. I did not do a ton of research on that part. So I did try to look it up quickly. I don't know if first published means. Igeres HaMusar literally means that it's a Musar letter, right? So it was a letter about Musar. I don't know if 1858 means the first time that it was like kind of published publicly. Maybe it was, I don't know if it was originally addressed right to his to a particular people, and then it was, you know, first put in a book in 1858. So I'm not completely sure, but in the mid 1900s is really what we're looking at. So the Igeres HaMusar, he has a long Oh, sorry, did I say 19? Yeah, mid-19th century, clarify. So the mid-1800s that he's writing the Igeres HaMusar, and he's giving advice, right? He has many, many letters. You can find them. They're collected in a sefer called Or Yisrael. Or Yisrael is a collection of the letters of Yisrael Salanter. So in it, he points out, this is actually almost at the end of the Igeres HaMusar. So he points out the following. He says that... that the Yetzer Hara is very difficult to fight. There are a lot of things that are pulling us in different directions, and sometimes it's hard to master it, right? Sometimes it's hard to overcome those pulls. So he gives some advice. This is his advice: Lezos Yasim Ha'adam El Libo. So therefore, a person should. Literally, Yasim El Libo, right? He should put it in his heart, or he should try, he should pay attention. Lezakos es harabim, to help out the rabbin, to help out the community, to help out everybody else. Le'oreram lehizbonunus hayira v'hamasar. So what should a person do? He should try, don't focus on yourself, he suggests. Don't focus on yourself. You should focus on the community, on the world. Le'oreram lehizbonunus hayira v'hamasar. In order to arouse in them, to bring to life for them the need for understanding Yira and Musar. So don't focus just on yourself. Instead, look out at the world. Help other people find and understand the world of Yira and Musar. Ki einei ha'adam pekuchos al achirim. Because people's eyes, eini ha'adam, are open on other people. They're open for other people. Ladas ulakir es chasrono sehim. In order to know and to recognize their faults, what they are missing, their own mistakes. V'chinit rachim hema l'musar l'merbe. Right, and that they are in need of musar for their own benefit. So his suggestion here is don't focus just on yourself, but focus on others. Recognize what they need, and support them by By helping them learn, helping teach them, Moser, so that they can improve themselves. So focus outwards. Umimela, skipping, right, just moving through the next line, right, so he's saying, and then really be strong about it and really focus on Moser. Umimela, la'at la'at, limur ha-Moser yadrichehu b'nisiv ha-tzedek. And Mimela, you know, through that process, la'at la'at, slowly, limur ha-Moser yadrichehu b'nisiv ha-tzedek. From there, you will, you know, slowly be able to develop and grow and improve over time. V'hi refuah gashmis v'gam ruchanis. This is this will help us physically and spiritually, right? The process of Musar, he's saying, is a spiritual endeavor, right? There is a coming closer to God and improving ourselves spiritually, and it also is a physical process and an improvement. There's also that goes hand in hand, and that should be the process that we should think about. K'maimar Chazal, as Chazal say, kol mezakes harabim ein chit ba al yado. So Chazal say in Yoma that anyone who is mezakes harabim, anyone who helps out the community, anyone who helps out others, ein chit ba al yado. So then you don't have any sin that goes in that person's hand. So this is like a little bit of a, right, what he's saying is a little bit of a spin, right, on this Maimar Chazal. Right, if we had looked at it beforehand, I sometimes try to do this, but if we had in this case we didn't read the Maimar Chazal first, but you'll have to play along with me, which is if you had read Kol Mezakes Harabim Ein Chit Ba Al Yado in a vacuum, if you had read that without Rav Yisrael Salanter, what does it sound like it means?
Like giving them tzedakah or something?
Right, so if you give tzedakah, if you're Mezakes Harabim, right, if you give to others, Ein chei ba'al yado, then what's going to happen?
Then you won't sin.
Right, you won't sin. Why? Because God will protect you, right? Like, if you help others, then God will protect you and make sure that you don't have any sins, right? So that's kind of like the pshat, quote-unquote, right? Like, the simple reading of this statement in Yoma is, right, and there's truth to it, right? There is a layer, one level of understanding this Gemara is, kol mezakes harabim, anyone who does something to benefit the community, so then God will protect that person. And Rav Yisrael Salanter is saying another reading of that line. He's pointing out, kol mezakes harabim, if you help others get better, right, if you work with others to improve their own lives, so then he's saying, la'at la'at, it'll bring everybody up. It'll help you improve also. It won't only improve the lives of those that you're helping, but it will also help you improve your own life. That it is through a process he's suggesting that of helping others improve their own position, that also then sinks in your own mind and in your own thinking for yourself, that then Ein chit ba'al yado. Now, just like if you were mezakes harabim, I helped them see the error of their ways, and I helped them kind of realign themselves with their values. So now, once you've helped other people do that, now you start to reflect back and say, well, I also have to do those same things, and those things that I was helping other people do, I am also going to do. Ve'ein chit ba'al yado. And now, you're not really going to sin, because through helping others, you've now realized what you were lacking in, and therefore you also will improve in those areas.
Isn't that somewhat counterintuitive? if Musar sort of translates into Midos, I mean, the way for me to improve my Midos is to just focus on improving
my Right. So,
I mean,
so
that to me is why, that's the question I think is bothering him, and that's why he brings us this Gemara.
Right.
Because the Gemara clearly said, I mean, his interpretation.
Right, his reading of this, yes, of this Gemara. Right, so we can point out that there is a he's making a counterintuitive argument here that Musar, which itself seems like it is so rooted in self-improvement, it is about looking inward and about understanding myself, and he's saying a way to accomplish that is by focusing on others. And he's arguing that it's by looking at others that that you can improve yourself. Now, we may also recognize that this, right, this may not happen completely in a, right, in, you may have to have a particular, right, this might not work for everyone, right? We might know lots of people who tell everyone else what to do, but don't seem to improve themselves at all, right? Like that. Right, exactly. So we might know of people who are constantly telling people what to do and don't seem to be taking it to heart.
You know, just a second, tying this to the Parsha, that what's the fault of Noah? He didn't go out to help others, and what happens as soon as he walks out of the teva, he does an aveira. He gets drunk, and it causes his son to do an aveira. So maybe if he would have done more to help people, if you follow this, that wouldn't have happened.
So this is a support, perhaps, something that lines up with what Rav Yisrael is arguing here. Just to clarify, is this this idea that we can continue to bring up. We'll bring up a little bit later as well. But this idea that one of the things that Noach perhaps is lacking in his relationship with everybody, so maybe one of the things that he's held to account for is that he is okay, right? Everybody else seems to have a problem. He is okay. But it doesn't seem to be a mission of his to help other people turn their life around, right? He doesn't really seem to spread the message, right? Hashem speaks to him, and he doesn't then say, like, wait a second, everybody, right? I was just told that we're on a path towards destruction. Maybe you guys need to change your way, He doesn't really seem to spread it. So,
That's why it took him 120.
Right, exactly. So maybe right. So we can continue kind of discuss it and bring it up as we go through more of this discussion. That there may be some conversations he has, but not. But it at the very least, it doesn't seem like he's going out to kind of bring the message to the people, and he doesn't seem to have. To borrow the language of Chazal as filtered through Rav Yisrael, right? He's not making it a mission of kol mezakeh harabim. He doesn't seem to be trying to get everybody else back on track. And potentially, this is connected to, we might argue, later on, right? Once he gets off, steps off of the teva, there is a mistake that Noach seems to make with. When he plants the vineyard and he gets drunk and his children find him. So that is a part of the story. When we were giving the summary, we kind of glossed over that part. But pointing out that Noach seems to make a mistake, potentially, maybe there's some relationship for the fact that Noach seems to slip back into some of the things that other people were failing in before. Maybe if he had a focus on helping others, maybe it would have filtered into his own life as well. So maybe that's kind of in line with what we're seeing here in the Igeres HaMusar. So this idea that I definitely understand using the word that is counterintuitive, right? There is something to that, and we can acknowledge the fact that not everybody who makes it their mission to go quote unquote improve other people, right, are actually going to take that as a message for themselves, that they also should help themselves. You may need another little piece, right? It may come with a little bit of a perspective. I was thinking of this piece from Ruach Chaim. So this didn't make it into the Marmakomos, but the Ruach Chaim is a commentary written by Rav Chaim Volozhiner. So Rav Chaim Volozhiner was a student of the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon who we're not going into the whole life of the Vilna Gaon, right? I was going to point out, right, the thing that's usually, right, in some of these contexts pointed out about the Vilna Gaon is that he is like the main opponent of the Baal Shem Tov and Chassidus in his time. And his student, Rav Chaim Volozhiner, the reason to spell it out here that he was an opponent of that is because his student, Rav Chaim Volozhiner, is famous for basically writing the book that like laid down the philosophy of the students of the Gra. The Gra is the Vilna Gaon. So the students of the Vilna Gaon, right, their philosophy and where they differ from Chassidus was kind of like, I don't want to say codified, it's not that simple. But he wrote the Nefesh HaChaim. So the Nefesh HaChaim was written by Rav Chaim Volozhiner, and that kind of lays out the philosophy rooted in the Vilna Gaon. And there are points where he's like either explicitly or implicitly addressing Chassidim and their own thoughts. So that's Nefesh HaChaim. So that's Rav Chaim Volozhiner. The same Rav Chaim Volozhiner wrote a commentary on Pirkei Avos. So just for that context of like, you might have heard of Nefesh HaChaim, you may have, and that Rav Chaim Volozhiner wrote Ruach Chaim. So that's a commentary on Pirkei Avos. So in his commentary on Pirkei Avos, he has a note here that points to a pasuk in Mishlei, Kemayim ha'panim lepanim, kein lev ha'adam la'adam. So like the water, right? Like a face mirrored in the water, right? A reflection, right? A reflection in the water. Kein lev ha'adam la'adam. So too are the hearts of a person towards another person. Okay, so just like a reflection in the water, so are people. So he points out, he argues the following. He says that Mishehu zach levav, somebody who's pure of heart, is not lo yargish klal, is not going to notice the sins of others, right? So somebody who, so what he's arguing is, kamayim hapanim lapanim, right? That if I see somebody else doing something wrong, so potentially what that means is that I myself am not perfect, if I notice those things in other people. And it's I should take this message to heart that when I see it in other people, so then I should stop and say, well, if I notice it in other people, maybe it's because there's something going on with me that that is actually being reflected back at me. And the note is, I think there is a similar idea, which is pointed out, I thought of the name of the Baal Shem Tov, I don't really have a source, but definitely from Torah's Chassidus, of a similar point, that when a person sees somebody doing, even if it's an actual chait, something that they see someone doing something wrong, that the immediate reaction should be, why was I shown this thing? It must be because I have something like that going on, and it's not it should be a note to myself to actually reflect on, why am I seeing this? Right? Why am I seeing this in somebody else? It must be that I'm really seeing something about myself. So,
you can't watch the news
anymore. I'm not saying you shouldn't watch the news. I mean, I'm not sure if everyone should watch the news, but I'm not going to tell people that they shouldn't watch the news. But I think
it's similar to maybe compared to why Nazir follows Sota, that someone who saw Sota should reflect on.
Right, so a nazir, in the Chumash, right, the parsha of Nazir, the description of a nazir who abstains from wine and cuts himself off from certain things, that follows the parsha of a sota, of somebody who, you know, who potentially committed adultery, right? And Chazal Svel Rashi there quotes that maybe the why does the nazir come second? Because if somebody sees Asota, somebody sees all of these bad things that might happen, so then what's the reaction? So then you take things upon yourself to prevent something like that from happening. So maybe there's another example where you see something out in the world, it's something you come across, it's something that like passes by you, and you take that as a message to, wait a second, now what am I going to do based on this thing that I'm seeing? So that's a similar point. So this idea of kamayim apanim lapanim, so this is just something to think about, that potentially this is, again, also related to the idea that one of the ways to understand ourselves is, what Rav Yisrael is arguing, is to kind of look out at others and through helping them, right? Through pointing out the thing, right, helping them learn Musar and understand what they may gain from it. So it may also, if I have this perspective of Kamayim Apanim Lapanim, and I say, you know, this thing that's happening in the world, it's not that I pretend it's not happening. It is happening out there in the world, right? There may be things that actually need to be fixed out in the world. And also, the fact that I'm able to point it out, I can now reflect back on myself and improve also. So he argues in the Igaros HaMusar that it's really this dual process. I'm really working outward, and then using that is kind of bringing all of us along for the ride. But why does this process work? Why does he argue that this works at all? Because he says, "Enei ha'adam pikuchos al achirim ladas l'hakeres chasronoseihem," right? Because if we sat down, right? What's the reality? If I sat down and said, be introspective, right? Figure out what, I'm not going to say this to anybody else. If I say to myself, right, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to think about what I did wrong. So there are limits to that. There are a lot of limits to thinking about yourself and to thinking, what did I do or what am I missing? It's very difficult to see the things that I myself am missing, right? If I'm missing it, so then how do I notice it, right? So this comes with there are certain things that I may not even know about, right? So that there may be chesronos, there may be things that are literally missing that, again, how am I going to think about it? And even things that I have, things that I do, I may not have the perspective to fully understand them, to reflect on them, to recognize that they even are there. But it's a lot easier to notice it about other people, right? It's a lot easier to look out at the world and say, I can tell you what everybody else is missing. I can tell you what everybody else is doing wrong, right? So Rav Yisrael Salanter is arguing that we can take that natural inclination, I don't know, whatever, right? That ability to look at others and notice things about others when it would be difficult to notice it about myself, and I can kind of use that to my advantage. So because that is the case, I can start to help others, and then through that process of helping others, I can start to take it to heart and really think about that idea, and then start to look back at myself and say, well, if this is the case out there, if this is what people do, or if this is what I'm seeing, do I do that? Do I do that same thing? Right? Do I also talk like that? Do I also act like that? Right? And you can start to, it'll start to filter its way backwards. And this is part of why Rav Yisrael also, in different places, he talks about the importance of learning Musar in a group. So this is something which, you know, sometimes we have nowadays like a Musarvad, right? Something like that, we might call it, which would be a group of people that get together to learn Musar. It's not exactly even, all right, what Rav Yisrael is describing may be a little bit different. When we talk about a Musarvad, so often that's like a small group of people and there's like a person who's leading the group and they together learn through a Sefer, right? Which itself is important and they discuss the ideas. But he goes even a little bit further. He describes people coming together to actually come face to face with what they're trying to deal with, right? It's not just somebody like reading the book. It's not just somebody explaining what people should do, but it is in a group a chance to actually discuss and for people to speak to each other about what they think they might need to improve on. It is it's a little bit of a potentially dangerous, you know, arrangement. This idea of coming together with a group of people to better understand yourself by having them actually reflect on each other, not just on themselves, but also there are things that, again, I won't necessarily notice about myself, but if I'm in a group and I'm in a safe place where, right, it is psychologically safe, where we recognize the, you know, the importance of every individual person and their value and their worth and the importance of what we're doing, so then you start to create a space where somebody might be able to point something else about myself that I will not take personally and I may be able to actually take to heart. So that's why he also describes this idea of learning Musar in a group. And even though that has kind of, again, fallen out of favor, we still have, like, again, Musar Vad. You might have, like, a group that, like, gets together to learn Musar. It's still not exactly what he's describing. But there's something, I think, somewhat similar that's described in, well, we have a source 3 in the book's Thinking in Bets. So this is a book by Annie Duke. Annie Duke is a, she was a psychologist, I want to say psychologist. I mean, she was a PhD candidate, but she ended up not finishing. And then she ended up joining, like, the World Series of Poker and becoming, like, a national poker champion. So I think she has since gone back. I don't know if she's, like, gone back to finish. So she wrote this book, Thinking in Bets. Her most recent book is – I think her most recent book is Quit. I think that's her. The importance of sometimes quitting, right? That sometimes we think, like, you're always supposed to push through and keep going. but weighing, maybe that's not always the case. Maybe there are times when is it appropriate to actually to just stop. So in this book, Thinking of Bets, so she describes some of the ways that our own thinking gets in the way of our lives, and also again through the lens of poker specifically, and how poker as a is a little bit of a different game than others, right? Like I think this is at the beginning of Thinking of Bets that, right, like to some extent in chess, right, there always is in chess an ideal move, right? Like I think like mathematically, like there is a best move at any given time in chess. You just have to know enough possibilities for it to like be possible, right? To figure it out. And like over time, if you're a master, so like you understand the patterns and you know what you're looking at and you can understand. But I think like poker, the element of chance is like throws everything off. So the element of that in that's the thinking in bets is part of this idea that we're not used to thinking in probabilities. Right, so that's part of this argument that like the way that we think in the world is very like specific, but reality is not like that. We have to kind of expand and recognize the role of probability in our lives. And one of the ways to do that, she argues, is to create what she calls a learning pod or a decision pod. So this was one of the ways that she improved her game was to connect to a group of like-minded people who would all reflect with each other back and forth about how they were doing and what their decisions were. And this was an opportunity to create a space where they could get a diversity of opinions, of different viewpoints. They could see things differently and actually have the freedom to say that, right? Because in a lot of contexts, as we can elaborate on at the end a little bit, right? In a lot of contexts, you're not supposed to say what you see is wrong, right? You're not supposed to point out when something is off. But if you create a certain context where that's okay, then people may benefit from that, right? You may actually be able to improve if you're able to actually express that in certain contexts. So she argues that it's almost impossible for us on our own to get the diversity of viewpoints provided by the combined manpower of a well-formed decision pod. So again, that's her phrase, a decision pod. To get a more objective view of the world, we need an environment that exposes us to alternate hypotheses and different perspectives, right? In order to actually come up with a different idea, we need to surround ourselves with that, right? It doesn't only apply to the world around us. To view ourselves in a more realistic way, we need other people to fill in our blind spots, right? There may be things even about ourselves. It's not even just that we're looking at the same event from different perspectives, but even myself, I think I know myself the best, and to some extent I do, but there are always going to be certain things that I'm missing that other people can shed light on. She argues that others aren't wrapped up in preserving our own narrative anchored by our biases, right? That there are reasons that I tell myself I'm okay, or there are reasons that I tell myself that explain what I do, but other people don't have that same, they don't have that same bias. They don't have that need to necessarily, see my life story the same way, okay? And she argues that it is a lot easier to have someone else offer their perspective than for you to imagine you're another person and think about what their perspective might be. So that's she's like alluding to the fact that there's another piece of advice we could have given, right? There is a context. Sometimes this is helpful, and maybe at some point we'll discuss this. It is helpful at some point to take an outside perspective and to say, imagine you're somebody else and you're viewing yourself. So that can be useful. But she's saying even better than that is literally having somebody else and asking them. So even better when there is a disagreement stemming from the diverse opinions represented, right? This is represented at a poker table. The discussion may naturally progress toward betting on it. And this is why it ties into her whole thesis, specifically, right, about the importance of end quote, betting. But she says that many groups have recognized the need to engineer the kind of diversity and encouragement of dissent that naturally occurs at the poker table, right? So there are organizations that recognize that this doesn't happen naturally because, right, there are many things which keep us from actually expressing when we see something that has gone wrong with somebody else. So even though Rav Yisrael Salanter said, oh, it helps to point out what other people did wrong, right? Obviously, that's not just happening like on the street. You don't just notice things and then just start talking bad about people, right? But so there are, if you're close with people, then there are reasons that you are not going to say everything that you think. So some organizations have tried to find ways to encourage dissent, diversity of opinion. The State Department, since the Vietnam War, has had a formal dissent channel where employees can have their dissenting views heard and addressed without fear of penalty, right? So that there is a way to actually get the information out there, the idea out there, without risking, you know, without risking your position or anything like that. Okay, the American Foreign Service Association, the professional organization of foreign service employees, has 4 separate awards given to recognize and encourage constructive dissent and risk taking. Right, so sometimes you have to create a formal avenue for people to express something that they see that could be improved, because for good reason, it's not always the appropriate thing to just say whatever you think, right? There is a benefit to it, right? There's a benefit that we gain from other people's perspectives, but you're also balancing it with the fact that you don't always want to hear it, right? Sometimes, right, this may not be, this is part of the warning, is what we're saying about Rav Yisrael Salanter, it's not necessary, right? This is not, now go out and whenever you see your friend doing something, like, point out what they're doing wrong. Or when they come to you and they're like, right, or a spouse comes to you and says like, oh man, like, it was terrible. I was in line at the store and the person said something that was insulting. You don't go like, well, what did you say first? Right? That's not really what they're looking for in that context, right? There are plenty of contexts where somebody is telling you something and you're not supposed to be trying to make it, you know, trying to improve them. So this is not free license to just go say whatever you want. But what we're describing is that there is a role potentially for creating a space where that happens, right? The normal social contract is that you don't get to just say what you think is wrong with me, but you can create a bubble where the contract actually is, we are trying to get better at this. And in order to get better, we need different views, and therefore you need to point things out. So that happens at the poker table, right? In improving, right? It happens potentially her examples were the State Department, right? It might happen at work. There may be, right, environments in work where we create a space where it is safe and it is not risky now to be able to express, I think something went wrong and we need to fix this thing, right? So there are times where you might, you know, keeping certain details in mind, create a space where that is the actual agreement, right? That agreement is that we actually are looking for these different opinions, and we are going to benefit from it. And Rav Yisrael Salanter says that there's a reason for that. There's a reason to create those kinds of groups in Musar, because we have blind spots to some of our own failings, right? Maybe I notice some of the things that I might do wrong, but there are definitely things that I'm missing that other people could shed light on. And in certain contexts, I can create a space where we use my inability to introspect and my ability to notice about other people. We can use that to our advantage in certain contexts where we can actually create that. Yes.
They used to call that the suggestion box.
Right. So you may have a suggestion box, right? Which may be
that's in the old days.
Right.
Where you offered people the opportunity to make comment on anything they wanted to make.
Exactly. So you may have like an anonymous comment often, right? Sometimes this has to do with, again, people putting things out there. Which, that's why at work it's also like there's like another element to it, and that's why in friendships there's an element to this where like you're risking a relationship or you're risking your position and things like that. So you there in certain contexts you may have to make it anonymous where you're able to do that. She also points out, which is why sometimes your decision pod, sometimes your Musar vod, should not necessarily be your best friends, right? Like, there's a place for, like, growing together, but, like, you don't necessarily want all of the people you're closest to be pointing out all of the things that you do wrong. And again, I'm like simplifying to say all of the things you're doing wrong. That's not the point. I'm making a little bit of a joke about it. But the point is, if you're actually going to improve, sometimes you might want to keep separate those the relationship and what you're working on.
That's what group therapy is all about.
So that's part of it as well. Working through group therapy, there are things that happen, and there are things that come to the surface through social interaction and through the viewpoints of others that would not have happened in a different context. Yeah, so that may touch on this. So all of this is rooted in this idea that Rav Yisrael Salanter phrased as ki einei ha'adam pekuchos al acherim, right? Everybody's eyes are open on everybody else, right? It's very easy for me to see. It's often easier for me to see things about other people, to notice the things that they're missing, because when I look at myself, I don't necessarily notice the context that I myself am in, right? The things that I take for granted, the things that I assume, right? It's often hard for us to question our own assumptions, right? Because we don't necessarily even know that they are assumptions, right? There are things that we take for granted that we would not notice, but we're able to notice when other people do it. Why did you do it like that? Oh, I never thought about it. I don't know. This is just always how I did it, right? So those kinds of things, there's a difference between being inside the situation, right? Being inside my own head is different than being outside the situation, looking in. And there are ways that I myself, within this environment, don't even notice things about this environment that somebody from outside would notice. And this, again, in an organizational context, right, that might be when somebody new is hired, when somebody comes from a different place and now comes into this context, they start to notice things. Why do you guys always wait in line at the copy machine instead of just like waiting till it's empty? I don't know, whatever it is, right? Like, why do you always, like, little things that, like, they may notice, like, about even just like a regular process that we didn't do it like that. So why do you do it like that? Those kinds of little things that from the outside you might notice, but you wouldn't necessarily notice inside. Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank is the source at the bottom of this page. Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank quotes the following. He's quoting somebody else in this case. This is in the Sefer on Chumash. Ve'amar Hagon Rav Yaakov Kalmas, ki mi shehu ba'atzmo mushchas u'mekulkal. This is going back to his original question. I thought I'd include the question. He doesn't have the question. The question here is, why is it that it says, v'tishachis ha'aretz lifnei halokim, that the earth, the world is v'tishachis, the world is mushchas, it's corrupted. And then God looks at the world, and behold, it's mushchas. Behold, it's corrupted. So it says the world was corrupted, and then God looked, and behold, it was corrupted. What's that repetition? Why does it say it happened, and then God looked and saw that it happened? So he says, kimi shehu ba'atzmo mushchas u'mekulkal, somebody who has a problem themselves, eino roe klal es ha'hashchasa hanitzeves lefanav. That person is often incapable of even seeing that. Again, he's using language from the pasuk of that corruption. He's not necessarily capable of seeing that problem. Mishum shelibo neta mehirgish roa hashchasa. His heart is closed off to even feeling the bad. Ve'inav tachu miros zos, and his eyes are covered. He can't even see. Can't even see what's right there.
But isn't he talking about God?
So in this case, he's saying the earth. The earth was corrupted. So from the perspective of everybody in the earth, that's just normal now. They see what they, when they look out at the world, they don't see hashchasa, they don't see corruption, they just see the world. This is the society we live in. This is what things are. So from the perspective of the world, you don't even notice that it happens, right? Maybe it happens over time. The Rambam elaborates a little bit on how they may have, like, reached that point, right? How things may have gone downhill, but it may happen over time. But at some point, right, step after step after step, this is just what we live in. This is the air we breathe. This is just where we are. V'rak mi shebe'asmo naki legamri v'sholim b'tachlis. And somebody who is not mushcha, somebody who's not corrupt, who roe umargish esroa ha'ashchascha asher lefanav. He is able, somebody from the outside, who's not a part of that system, somebody who's not corrupted the way that they are, somebody who's outside of that, is able to look at it and say, there's something off here. There's something missing. I will note that this is slightly different than what we quoted before. Okay, there's a little bit different than the Ruach Chaim, so there's definitely something that's worth talking about. Because here we're talking about from Hashem, right? But Hashem is showing us, the way the Torah is describing it, is that the earth is corrupt. The earth is having these problems. Vayara Elokim es ha'orez v'hine nishchasa. And God looks from outside and says, whoa, something's off here. Because from inside the system, it's not clear. From inside the system, this is just the way the world is. These are the assumptions that we have. This is how you treat people. This is how you go. This is how you are in the world. This is how you act. But Hashem from outside, v'zeh she'amar ha'kosov she'arz nishchasa lifnei ha'lokim. So that's what the pasuk says, that the land was nishchas, the world was corrupt. Aval af echad mi'ador lo ra'av lo hirgish zos. But nobody feels that. Nobody feels like something is wrong. Mishum she'ador kulo haya mushchas u'mikulkal. Because the whole generation is mushchas u'mikulkal. V'rak elokim hu levado ra'as ha'arz v'nei nishchasa. Only God alone can see that the world is corrupt, can see that there's a different way of doing it. Only God above can see that, above quote unquote, that something is off here. Aval ish me anshei ador hahu lo ra'u v'lo hirgishu. But the people of the generation couldn't feel that, because that's just who they were. That's just part of the environment that they were in, and they needed an outside perspective.
Welcome to today.
Oh, all right. Okay. So I don't know if it's true. I might say, I don't know if it's more true today than any other time, in the sense that people in their time may take for granted the environment that they're in, right? That is true. We may talk, potentially, we're still talking about the hashchasa of the corruption of the world. But again, at any given point in time, it's usually the people of that time that's just the way it is. That's just the way the world is. Now, what he doesn't say, which is interesting, I don't know that I have a full answer or explanation, right? But there's one person who potentially could have served this role that doesn't. And he doesn't address this, but in the way he's quoting it, so I don't know if this is the original, the way he heard it, or this is Rav Zvi Pesach Frank's, interpretation of it, but the way that he's saying it is shehador kulo haya mushchas af echad mihador lo ra'av lo hirgish dos. Yeah. Right? Nobody, there's not a single person who noticed that something was off.
What about Noah?
Right? So again, I don't know exactly what to do. It's something maybe to continue to think about, that the way he's presenting it is that Hashem has to come to Noah and say, Noah, you're not crazy. I'm telling you, right? Like Noah may think like, I don't know, something's a little bit off, right? Obviously, he's not going along with what they're doing, right? But he's the only one, right? Is he ready to like stand up and be like, everybody else is wrong? Maybe not until Hashem says, like, Noah, no, you're on the right track. I know, like, I see it. I see you. I see what's going on. So maybe that's part of it, is that this ties into what we might have been saying before, that there may be something in Noah that also keeps him from bringing the message to other people. That's why she says, while he's building the teva, maybe people are coming to him, right? And they're like, what are you doing? And then he kind of explains it. But first of all, the fact that he, again, I don't know, maybe he doesn't completely, not until Hashem actually speaks to him, does Noach even really maybe know that he's right. This may tie also to some things we talked about, that sometimes people came to him and they were like, Noach, you're so weird. Why are you building that teva? And he's like, no, you're all bad people. The world's going to be destroyed. When we were talking about giving mussar and creating a context where you can point things out about other people, maybe that's not the context that would work to actually point out things that have gone wrong. Right? We talked about, last year we actually talked about motivated beliefs, right? That Right? There's a reason that they're acting the way they are. They're actually benefiting from it. Right? There's a reason that they're corrupt because they're getting stuff out of it. So to just point out, the argument you have with them, to just say like, no, you're wrong. Right? Maybe that's not a context that the social contract would not allow him to point out things that they're doing wrong. They're not really looking for that. So there may be reasons that Noach's role doesn't really serve this role, right? He doesn't serve as an outsider who's able to shed light on what they're doing. Yonah went to Nineveh, right? Apparently there are times that a person can come in and say, watch out, destruction is coming, something's going to happen, and people will start to listen. Okay, maybe we have to figure out what the differences are. But there are contexts where it does happen, but for some reason, Noach is not that person. Noach is not the person who, for this is like food for thought going forward. Why is Noach not this person who is able to do it? But it sounds like the way the Torah is describing it here, Hashem is the one coming from the outside to say, V'nei nishchasa, Hashem looks at it and goes, whoa, look at that. Things are way off, right? That the people within the system would not necessarily have been able to see. So we started with this basic, this question of the repetition in the psukim, that the world was corrupted, and then Hashem looks and sees that the world is corrupted. What's that repetition? So we built up this idea that the importance of perspectives, of other people's perspectives, even in my own improvement, right? That one of the ways that that I can help myself is by recognizing that I lack the ability to fully see my own context, my own assumptions, and my own behaviors. And sometimes I need other people to do that with me, right? And to be able to shed light on that through what Annie Du calls a decision pod or a learning pod, right? What Rav Yisrael Salanter might call a musirvad, right? There are contexts when we can create a space that other people can help me see the things that I can't see myself, because when I'm inside, I don't necessarily see it, but I can only see it from the outside. And that, what the Har Tzvi is suggesting, is that's part of this message, that Hashem is the one who's able to see. Vayar Elokim. Everybody in the generation itself couldn't tell what was wrong. They couldn't see what was actually missing. And it's only Vayar Elokim, it's only that Hashem could look from the outside, looking outside the system and be able to say, to recognize it. So again, I'm not sending people off to go tell everybody what they're doing wrong. This is not a free license to do that. This may be, maybe it is a license to invite others to point it out about ourselves. I don't know. I don't want to say that about anybody. I can only say that about myself. But just the recognition, this idea, just this balance between being within the system, being inside, and the blind spots that come with it, versus being the outside, is something to think about. And the role of Noach is also something to just think about. What could Noach, again, it's hard for me to say, what could Noach have done? But even just to think about, what is the Torah trying to tell us about Noach and his role, and what we can learn from that as well.